Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Warbreaker, Part 1, created by Brandon Sanderson, narrated by Dylan Lynch, with performances by James Konacek, Ken Jackson, Ren Casey, Elizabeth Jernigan, Colleen Delaney, Tim Getman, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, Mort Shelby, Terrence Aselford, Sonny Lasky, Eric Messner, Tom Simpson, Nanette Savard, Amanda Thickpenny, and Andy Clements. Warbreaker, Part 1.
It's funny how many things begin with me getting thrown into prison.
Vosher stood and dusted himself off, rolling his shoulder. While the bottom half of his cell door was solid wood, the top half was barred, and he could see the three guards open his large duffel and rifle through his possessions. One of them noticed him watching. The guard was an oversized beast of a man with a shaved head and a dirty uniform that barely retained the bright yellow and blue coloring of the Tetelir City Guard.
Bright colors. I'll have to get used to those again.
In any other nation, the vibrant blues and yellows would have been ridiculous on soldiers. This, however, was Halandrin, land of returned gods, lifeless servants, biochromatic research, and of course, color. The large guard sauntered up to the cell door, leaving his friends to amuse themselves with Vosher's belongings.
They say you're pretty tough. Bartender says you beat down some 20 men in a brawl. You don't look that tough to me. Either way, you should have known better than to strike a priest. The others, they'll spend a night locked up. You, though, you'll hang, colorless fool.
Vosher turned away. His cell was functional, if unoriginal. A thin slit at the top of one wall let in the light. The stone walls dripped with water and moss, and a pile of dirty straw decomposed in the corner.
You ignoring me?
The guard stepped closer to the door. The colors of his uniform brightened, as if he'd stepped into a stronger light. The change was slight. Vosher didn't have much breath remaining, and so his aura didn't do much to the colors around him. The guard didn't notice the change in color, just as he hadn't noticed back in the bar when he and his buddies had picked Vosher up off the floor and thrown him into their cart. Of course, the change was so slight to the unaided eye that it would have been nearly impossible to pick out.
Oh, here now. What's this?
Vosher had always found it interesting that the men who watched dungeons tended to be as bad as, or worse than, the men they guarded. Perhaps that was deliberate. Society didn't seem to care if such men were outside the cells or in them, so long as they were kept away from more honest men, assuming that such a thing existed. From Vasha's bag, a guard pulled free a long object wrapped in white linen. The man unwrapped the cloth, revealing a long, thin-bladed sword in a silver sheath. The hilt was pure black.
Who do you suppose he stole this from?
The lead guard eyed Vosher, likely wondering if Vosher were some kind of nobleman. Though Halandrin had no aristocracy, many neighboring kingdoms had their lords and ladies. Yet what lord would wear a drab brown cloak ripped in several places? What lord would sport bruises from a bar fight, a half-grown beard, and boots worn from years of walking? The guard turned away, apparently convinced that Vosher was no lord. He was right, and he was wrong.
Let me see that.
The lead guard took the sword. The guard was obviously surprised by its weight. He turned it about, noting the clasp that tied the sheath to hilt, keeping the blade from being drawn. He undid the clasp. The colors in the room deepened. They didn't grow brighter, not like the guard's vest had when he approached Vosher. Instead, they grew stronger, darker. Reds became maroon, yellows hardened to gold, blues approached navy.
Be careful, friend. That sword can be dangerous.
The guard looked up. All was still. Then the guard walked away from Vasher's cell, still carrying the sword. The other two followed, bearing Vasher's duffel, entering the guard room at the end of the hallway. Vasher immediately knelt beside the patch of straw, selecting a handful of sturdy lengths. He pulled threads from his cloak, it was beginning to fray at the bottom, and tied the straw into the shape of a small person, perhaps 3 inches high, with bushy arms and legs. He plucked a hair from one of his eyebrows, set it against the straw figure's head, then reached into his boot and pulled out a brilliant red scarf. Then, Vasher breathed.
My breath to you.
It flowed out of him, puffing into the air, translucent yet radiant like the color of oil on water in the sun. Vasher felt it leave. Biochromatic breath, scholars called it. Most people just called it breath. Each person had one. Or at least, that was how it usually went. One person, one breath. Vasher had around 50 breaths, just enough to reach the first heightening. Having so few made him feel poor compared to what he'd once held. But many would consider 50 breaths to be a great treasure. Unfortunately, even awakening a small figure made from organic material, using a piece of his own body as a focus, drained away some half of his breaths. The little straw figure jerked, sucking in the breath. In Vasher's hand, half of the brilliant red scarf faded to gray. Vasher leaned down, imagining what he wanted the figure to do, and completed the final step of the process as he gave the command.
Fetch keys.
The straw figure stood and raised its single eyebrow toward Vasher. Vasher pointed toward the guard room.
Not much time.
The straw person ran along the floor, then jumped up, vaulting between the bars. Vasher pulled off his cloak and set it on the floor. It was the perfect shape of a person, marked with rips that matched the scars on Vasher's body, its hood cut with holes to match Vasher's eyes. The closer an object was to human shape and form, the fewer breaths it took to awaken. Vasher leaned down, trying not to think of the days when he'd had enough breaths to awaken without regard for shape or focus. That had been a different time. Vasher pulled a tuft of hair from his head, then sprinkled it across the hood of the cloak.
My life to give, my breath to live.
It took the rest of his breath. With it gone, the cloak trembling, the scarf losing the rest of its color, Vasher felt dimmer. Losing one's breath was not fatal. Indeed, the extra breaths Vasher used had once belonged to other people. Vasher didn't know who they were. He hadn't gathered these breaths himself. They had been given to him. But, of course, that was the way it was always supposed to work. One could not take breath by force. Being void of breath did change him. Colors didn't seem as bright. He couldn't feel the bustling people moving about in the city above, a connection he normally took for granted. It was the awareness all men had for others, that thing which whispered a warning in the drowsiness of sleep when someone entered the room. In Vasher, that sense had been magnified 50 times, and now it was gone. Sucked into the cloak and the straw person, giving them power. The cloak jerked. Vasher leaned down.
Protect me.
The cloak grew still. He stood, throwing it back on. The straw figure returned to his window. It carried a large ring of keys. The figure's straw feet were stained red. The crimson blood seemed so dull to Vasher now. He took the keys.
Thank you.
Vasher always thanked them. He didn't know why, particularly considering what he did next.
I'm sorry. Your breath to mine.
Vasher touched the straw person's chest. The straw person immediately fell backward off the door, life draining from it, and Vasher got his breath back. The familiar sense of awareness returned, the knowledge of connectedness, of fitting. He could only take the breath back because he'd awakened this creature himself. Indeed, awakenings of this sort were rarely permanent. He used his breath like a reserve, doling it out, then recovering it. Compared to what he had once held, 25 breaths was a laughably small number. However, compared to nothing, It seemed infinite. The dungeon fell still. He had to keep moving. Vasha reached through the bars using the key to unlock his cell. Vasha rushed out into the hallway, leaving the straw figure discarded on the ground. He didn't walk to the guard room and the exit beyond it, but instead turned south, penetrating deeper into the dungeon. This was the most uncertain part of his plan. Finding a tavern that was frequented by priests of the iridescent tones had been easy enough. Getting into a bar fight, then striking one of those same priests, had been equally simple. Halandrans took their religious figures very seriously, and Vasher had earned himself not the usual imprisonment in a local jail, but a trip to the God King's dungeons. Knowing the kind of men who tended to guard such dungeons, he'd had a pretty good idea that they would try to draw Nightblood. That had given him the diversion he'd needed to get the keys. But now came the unpredictable part. Vasher stopped, awakened cloak rustling. It was easy to locate the cell he wanted, for around it a large patch of stone had been drained of color, leaving both walls and doors a dull gray. It was a place to imprison an awakener, for no color meant no awakening. Vasher stepped up to the door, looking through the bars. A man hung by his arms from the ceiling, naked and chained. His color was vibrant to Vasher's eyes, his skin a pure tan, his bruises brilliant splashes of blue and violet. The man was gagged, another precaution. In order to awaken, the man would need three things: breath, color, and a command. The harmonics and the hues, some called it. The iridescent tones, the relationship between color and sound. A command had to be spoken clearly and firmly in the awakener's native language. Any stuttering, any mispronunciation would invalidate the awakening. The breath would be drawn out, but the object would be unable to act. Vasher stepped inside the cell. The man's aura made colors glow brighter by sharp measure when they got closer. Anyone would be able to notice an aura that strong, though it was much easier for someone who had reached the first heightening. It wasn't the strongest biochromatic aura Vasher had ever seen. Those belonged to the returned, known as gods here in Halandrin. Still, the prisoner's biochroma was very impressive, and much, much stronger than Vasher's own. The prisoner held a lot of breaths, hundreds upon hundreds of them. The man swung in his bonds, studying Vasher, gagged lips bleeding from lack of water. Vasher hesitated only briefly, then reached up and pulled the gag free.
You. Are you here to free me?
No, Vahir. I'm here to kill you.
Captivity hadn't been easy on him. When Vasher had last seen Vahir, he'd been plump. Judging by his emaciated body, he'd been without food for some time now. The cuts, bruises, and burn marks on his flesh were fresh. Both the torture and the haunted look in Vahir's bag-rimmed eyes bespoke a solemn truth. Breath could only be transferred by willing, intentional command. That command could, however, be encouraged.
So, you judge me just like everyone else.
Your failed rebellion is not my concern. I just want your breath.
You and the entire Halandrin court.
Yes, but you're not going to give it to one of the returned. You're going to give it to me, in exchange for killing you.
Doesn't seem like much of a trade.
There was a hardness, a void of emotion in Vahir that Vasher had not seen the last time they had parted, years before.
Odd that I should finally, after all this time, find something in the man that I can identify with.
Vasher kept a wary distance from Vahir. Now that the man's voice was free, he could command. However, he was touching nothing except for the metal chains, and metal was very difficult to awaken. It had never been alive, and it was far from the form of a man. Even during the height of his power, Vasher himself had only managed to awaken metal on a few select occasions. Of course, some extremely powerful awakeners could bring objects to life that they weren't touching, but which were in the sound of their voice. That, however, required the ninth heightening. Even Vahir didn't have that much breath. In fact, Vasher knew of only one living person who did, the God King himself. That meant Vasher was probably safe. Vahir contained a great wealth of breath, but had nothing to awaken. Vasher walked around the chain man, finding it very difficult to offer any sympathy. Vahir had earned his fate. Yet the priests would not let him die while he held so much breath. If he died, it would be wasted. Gone. Irretrievable. Not even the government of Halandrin, which had such strict laws about the buying and passing of breath, could let such a treasure slip away. They wanted it badly enough to forestall the execution of even a high-profile criminal like Vahir. In retrospect, they would curse themselves for not leaving him better guarded. But then, Bashar had been waiting 2 years for an opportunity like this one.
Well?
Give me the breath, Vahir.
I doubt you have the skill of a god-king's torturers, Vasha. And I've withstood them for 2 weeks now.
You would be surprised, but that doesn't matter. You are going to give me your breath. You know you have only 2 choices. Give it to me, or give it to them. You don't have much time to consider. Any moment now, someone is going to discover the dead guards outside. The alarm will be raised. I'll leave you. You will be tortured again, and you will eventually break. Then all the power you've gathered will go to the very people you vowed to destroy.
Vahir stared at the floor. Bashar let him hang for a few moments and could see that the reality of the situation was clear to him. Finally, Vahir looked up at Bashar.
That thing you bear, it's here in the city.
Bashar nodded.
Screams I heard earlier. It caused them.
Bashar nodded again.
How long will you be in Taitalir?
For a time. A year, perhaps.
Will you use it against them?
My goals are my own to know, Vahir. Will you take my deal or not? Quick death in exchange for those breaths. I promise you this. Your enemies will not have them.
It's yours.
Bashar reached over, resting his hand on Bahir's forehead. Careful not to let any part of his clothing touch the man's skin, lest Bahir draw forth color for awakening. Bahir didn't move. He looked numb. Then, just as Bashar began to worry that the prisoner had changed his mind, Bahir breathed. Color drained from him, the beautiful iridescence, the aura that had made him look majestic despite his wounds and chains. It flowed from his mouth, hanging in the air, shimmering like mist. Bashar drew it in, closing his eyes.
My life to yours, my breath.
The breath flooded into Bashar, and everything became vibrant. His brown cloak now seemed deep and rich in color. The blood on the floor was intensely red, as if aflame. Even Bahir's skin seemed a masterpiece of color, the surface marked by deep black hairs, blue bruises, and sharp red cuts. It had been years since Bashar had felt such life. He fell to his knees as it overwhelmed him, and he had to drop a hand to the stone floor to keep himself from toppling over.
How did I live without this?
Bashar knew that his senses hadn't actually improved, yet he felt so much more alert, more aware of the beauty of sensation. When he touched the stone floor, he marveled at its roughness and the sound of wind passing through the thin dungeon window up above. It had always been that melodic? How could he not have noticed?
Keep your part of the bargain.
Bashar noted the tones in his voice, the beauty of each one, how close they were to harmonics. Bashar had gained perfect pitch, a gift for anyone who reached the second heightening. It would be good to have that again. Bashar could, of course, have up to the fifth heightening at any time if he wished. That would require certain sacrifices he wasn't willing to make. And so he forced himself to do it the old-fashioned way, by gathering breaths from people like Bahir. Bashar stood, then pulled out the colorless scarf he had used earlier. He tossed it over Bahir's shoulder, then breathed. Bashar didn't bother making the scarf have human shape, didn't need to use a bit of his hair or skin for a focus. though he did have to draw the color from his shirt. Basher met Vahir's resigned eyes.
Strangle things.
Basher's fingers touched the quivering scarf. It twisted immediately, pulling away a large yet now inconsequential amount of breath. The scarf quickly wrapped around Vahir's neck, tightening, choking him. Vahir didn't struggle or gasp. He simply watched Basher with hatred until his eyes bulged and he died.
Hatred.
Basher had known enough of that in his time. He quietly reached up and recovered his breath from the scarf, then left Vahir dangling in his cell. Basher passed quietly through the prison, marveling at the color of the woods and the stones. After a moment of walking, he noticed a new color in the hallway. Red. He stepped around the pool of blood, which was seeping down the inclined dungeon floor, and moved into the guard room. The three guards lay dead. One of them sat in a chair. Nightblood, still mostly sheathed, had been rammed through the man's chest. About an inch of a dark black blade was visible beneath the silver sheath. Basher carefully slid the weapon fully back into its sheath. He did up the clasp.
I did very well today.
Basher didn't respond to the sword.
I killed them all. Aren't you proud of me?
Basher picked up the weapon, accustomed to its unusual weight, and carried it in one hand. He recovered his duffel and slung it over his shoulder.
I knew you'd be impressed.
There were great advantages to being unimportant. True, by many people's standards, Ciri wasn't unimportant. She was, after all, the daughter of a king. Fortunately, her father had four living children, and Ciri, at 17 years of age, was the youngest. Fafn, the daughter just older than Ciri, had done the family duty and become a monk. Above Fafn was Ridger, the eldest son. He would inherit the throne. And then there was Vivenna. Ciri walked down the path back to the city. Vivenna, the firstborn, was, well, Vivenna. Beautiful, poised, perfect in most every way. It was a good thing, too, considering the fact that she was betrothed to a god. Either way, Ciri, as fourth child, was redundant. Vivenna and Ridger had to focus on their studies. Fafn had to do her work in the pastures and homes. Ciri, however, could get away with being unimportant. That meant she could disappear into the wilderness for hours at a time. People would notice, of course, and she would get into trouble. Yet even her father would have to admit that her disappearance hadn't caused much inconvenience. The city got along just fine without Ciri. In fact, it tended to do a little better when she wasn't around. Unimportance. To another, it might have been offensive. To Ciri, however, it was a blessing. She smiled, walking into the city proper. She drew the inevitable stares. While Bavalis was technically the capital of Idris, it wasn't that big, and everyone knew her by sight. Judging by the stories Ciri had heard from passing ramblemen, her home was hardly even a village compared to the massive metropolises in other nations. She liked it the way it was, even with the muddy streets, the thatched cottages, and the boring yet sturdy stone walls. Women chasing runaway geese, men pulling donkeys laden with spring seed, and children leading sheep on their way to pasture. A grand city in Zaka, Hudris, or even terrible Halandrin might have exotic sights, but it would be crowded with faceless, shouting, jostling crowds and haughty noblemen. Not Ciri's preference. She generally found even Vivalis to be a bit busy for her.
Still.
Ciri looked down at her utilitarian gray dress.
I'll bet those cities have more colors. That's something I might like to see.
Her hair wouldn't stand out so much there. As usual, the long locks had gone blonde with joy while she'd been out in the fields. She concentrated, trying to rein them in, but she was only able to bring the color to a dull brown. As soon as she stopped focusing, her hair just went back to the way it had been. She'd never been very good at controlling it. Not like Vivenna. As she continued through the town, a group of small figures began trailing her. She smiled, pretending to ignore the children until one of them was brave enough to run forward and tug on her dress.
Oh!
Then Ciri turned, smiling. They regarded her with solemn faces. Idris' children were trained, even at this age, to avoid shameful outbursts of emotion. Austrian teaching said there was nothing wrong with feelings, but drawing attention to yourself with them was wrong. Ciri had never been very devout. It wasn't her fault, she reasoned, if Austria had made her with a distinct inability to obey. The children waited patiently until Ciri reached into her apron and pulled out a couple of brightly colored flowers. The children's eyes opened wide, gazing at the vibrant colors. Three of the flowers were blue, one yellow. The flowers stood out starkly against the town's determined drabness. Other than what one could find in the skin and eyes of the people, there wasn't a drop of color in sight. Stones had been whitewashed, clothing bleached gray or tan, all to keep the color away. But without color, there could be no awakeners. The girl who had tugged Ciri's skirt finally took the flowers in one hand and dashed away with them, the other children following behind. Ciri caught a look of disapproval in the eyes of several passing villagers. None of them confronted her, though. Being a princess, even an unimportant one, did have its perks. She continued on toward the palace. It was a low, single-story building with a large, packed earth courtyard. Ciri avoided the crowds of haggling people at the front, rounding to the back and going to the kitchen entrance. Mab, the kitchen mistress, eyed Ciri.
Your father's been looking for you, child.
I suspect that he has.
Ciri walked over and looked into the pot Mab was working on, which bore the scent of a hearty stew.
Went to the hills again, didn't you? Skipped your tutorial sessions, I'll bet.
Ciri smiled, then pulled out another of the bright yellow flowers, spinning it between two fingers.
And been corrupt in the city youth again, I suspect. Honestly, girl, you should be beyond these things at your age. Your father will have words with you about shirking your responsibilities.
I like words, and I always learn a few new ones when father gets angry. I shouldn't neglect my education, now should I? Honestly, Mab.
Ciri twirled the flower, feeling her hair shade a little bit red.
I don't see what the problem is. Austria made the flowers, right? He put the colors on them, so they can't be evil. I mean, we call him God of Colors, for heaven's sake.
Flowers ain't evil, assuming they're left where Austri put them. We shouldn't use Austri's beauty to make ourselves more important.
A flower doesn't make me look more important.
Oh? You tell me. You really think walking through the city with a flower like that didn't draw attention to yourself?
That's only because the city is so drab. If there were a bit more color around, nobody would notice a flower.
You'd have us decorate the place like Halandrin. Maybe we should start inviting awakeners into the city? How'd you like that? Some devil sucking the souls out of our children, strangling people with their own clothing, bringing men back from the grave, then using their dead bodies for cheap labor, sacrificing women on their unholy altars.
Ciri felt her hair whiten slightly with anxiety.
Stop that!
The hair seemed to have a mind of its own, responding to gut feelings.
That sacrificing maiden's part is only a story. They don't really do that.
Stories come from somewhere.
Yes, they come from old women sitting by the hearth in the winter. Either way, I don't think we need to be so frightened. The Halandrins will do what they want, which is fine by me, as long as they leave us alone. Besides, we've got the treaty, Mab. Father and Vivenna will make sure we're safe, and that will make the Halandrins leave us alone.
And if they don't?
They will. You needn't worry.
They have better armies, better steel, more food, and those things. It makes people worry. Maybe not you, but sensible folk.
The cook's words were hard to dismiss out of hand. Mab had a sense, a wisdom beyond her instinct for spices and broths. However, she also tended to fret.
You're worrying about nothing, Mab. You'll see.
I'm just saying that this is a bad time for a royal princess to be running around with flowers, standing out and inviting Austria's dislike.
Fine, then. Now we can all stand out together.
Ciri dropped the flower she had been twirling into the pot. Mab froze, then rolled her eyes.
I assume that was of a novel flower.
Of course. I know better than to ruin a good stew. And I still say you're overreacting.
Here.
Mab pulled out another knife.
Make yourself useful. There's roots that need chopping.
Shouldn't I report to my father?
Ciri grabbed a gnarled venavo root and began to chop.
He'll just send you back here and make you work in the kitchens as a punishment.
Oh, Austri, help me if Father ever discovers I like it down here.
You just like being close to the food.
Mab fished Ciri's flour out of the stew and tossed it aside.
Either way, you can't report to him. He's in conference with Yarda.
Ciri gave no reaction. She simply continued to chop. Her hair, however, grew blonde with excitement.
Father's conferences with Yarda usually last hours. Not much point in simply sitting around waiting for him to get done.
Mab turned to get something off the table, and by the time she looked back, Ciri had bolted out the door and was on her way toward the royal stable. Bare minutes later, she galloped away from the palace, wearing her favorite brown cloak, feeling an exhilarated thrill that sent her hair into a deep blonde. A nice quick ride would be a good way to round out the day. After all, the punishment was likely to be the same either way. Dedalan, King of Idris, set the letter down on his desk. He had stared at it long enough. It was time to decide whether or not to send his eldest daughter to her death. Despite the advent of spring, his chamber was cold. Warmth was a rare thing in the Idris Highlands. It was coveted and enjoyed, for it lingered only briefly each summer. The chambers were also stark. There was a beauty in simplicity. Even a king had no right to display arrogance by ostentation. Dedalan stood up, looking out his window and into the courtyard. The palace was small by the world's standards, only a single story high with a peaked wooden roof and squat stone walls. But it was large by Idris standards, and it bordered on flamboyant. This could be forgiven, for the palace was also a meeting hall and center of operations for his entire kingdom. The king could see General Yarda out of the corner of his eye. The burly man stood waiting, his hands clasped behind his back, his thick beard tied in three places. He was the only other person in the room. Dedalan glanced back at the letter. The paper was a bright pink, and the garish color stood out on his desk like a drop of blood in the snow. Pink was a color one would never see in Idris. In Halandrin, however, center of the world's dye industry, such tasteless hues were commonplace.
Well, old friend, do you have any advice for me?
General Yarda shook his head.
War is coming, Your Majesty. I feel it in the winds, and I read it in the reports of our spies. Halandrin still considers us rebels, and our passes to the north are too tempting. They will attack.
Then I shouldn't send her.
Dedalan looked back out of his window. The courtyard bustled with people in furs and cloaks coming to market.
We can't stop the war, Your Majesty, but we can slow it.
Dedalan turned back. Yarda stepped forward.
This is not a good time. Our troops still haven't recovered from those Vendis raids last fall. With the fires in the granary this winter, we cannot afford to get into a defensive war in the summer. Our best ally against the Halandrin are the Snows. We can't let this conflict occur on their terms. If we do, we're dead.
The words all made sense.
Your Majesty, they are waiting for us to break the treaty as an excuse to attack. If we move first, they will strike.
If we keep the treaty, they will still strike.
But later, perhaps months later. You know how slow Halandrin politics are. If we keep the treaty, there will be debates and arguments. If those last until the snows, then we will have gained the time we need so badly.
It all made sense. Brutal, honest sense. All these years, Dedalan had stalled and watched as the Halandrin court grew more and more aggressive, more and more agitated. Every year, voices called for an assault on the rebel Idrians living up in the highlands. Every year, those voices grew louder and more plentiful. Every year, Dedalan's placating in politics kept the armies away. He had hoped, perhaps, that the rebel leader Vahir and his Pan Kal dissidents would draw attention away from Idris, but Vahir had been captured. His so-called army dispersed. His actions had only served to make Halandrin more focused on its enemies. The peace would not last. Not with Idris ripe. Not with the trade routes worth so much. Not with the current crop of Halandrin gods, who seemed so much more erratic than their predecessors. Dedalan knew all of that. But he also knew that breaking the treaty would be foolish. When you were cast into the den of a beast, you did not provoke it to anger. Yarda joined him beside the window, looking out, leaning one elbow against the side of the frame. He was a harsh man, born of harsh winters. But he was also as good a man as Dedalyn had ever known. A part of the king longed to marry Vivenna to the general's own son. That was foolish. Dedalyn had always known this day would come. He'd crafted the treaty himself, and it demanded he send his daughter to marry the God King. The Halandra needed a daughter of the royal blood to reintroduce the traditional bloodline into their monarchy. It was something the depraved and vainglorious people of the lowlands had long coveted, and only that specific clause in the treaty had saved Idris these 20 years. The treaty had been the first official act of Dedalyn's reign, negotiated furiously following his father's assassination. Dedalyn gritted his teeth. How quickly he'd bowed before the whims of his enemies. Yet he would do it again, and Idris Monarch would do anything for his people. That was one big difference between Idris and Halandrin.
If we send her, Yarda, we send her to her death.
Maybe they won't harm her.
You know better than that. The first thing they'll do when the war comes is use her against me. This is Halandrin. They invite awakeners into their palaces for Austria's sake.
Yarda fell silent. Finally, he shook his head.
Latest reports say their army has grown to include some 40,000 lifeless.
Lord God of Colors.
Dedalyn glanced at the letter again. Its language was simple. Vivenna's 22nd birthday had come, and the terms of the treaty stipulated that Dedalyn could wait no longer.
Sending Vivenna is a poor plan, but it's our only plan. With more time, I know we can bring the Tetradel to our cause. They've hated Halandrin since the Many War. And perhaps I can find a way to rile Vahir's broken rebel faction in Halandrin itself. At the very least, we can build, gather supplies, live another year.
Yarda turned to Dedalyn.
If we don't send the Halandrin their princess, the war will be seen as our fault. Who will support us? They'll demand to know why we refuse to follow the treaty our own king wrote.
And if we do send them, Vivenna, it will introduce the royal blood into their monarchy, and they will have an even more legitimate claim on the Highlands.
Perhaps. But if we both know they're going to attack anyway, then what do we care about their claim? At least this way. Perhaps they'll wait until an heir is born before the assault comes.
More time. The general always asked for more time. But what about when that time came at the cost of Dedalyn's own child?
Yarda wouldn't hesitate to send one soldier to die if it would mean time enough to get the rest of his troops into better position to attack. We are Idris. How can I ask anything less of my daughter than I demand from one of my troops?
It was just that thinking of Vivenna in the God King's arms being forced to bear that creature's child, it nearly made his hair bleach with concern. The child would become a stillborn monster who would become the next returned god of the Halandrin.
There is another way. You don't have to send Vivenna. Enter!
Dedalyn should have been able to guess whom it would be. Vivenna stood in a quiet gray dress, looking so young to him still. Yet she was the perfect image of an Idris woman, hair kept in a modest knot, no makeup to draw attention to the face. She was not timid or soft like some noble women from the northern kingdoms. She was just composed. Composed, simple, hard, and capable. Idrian.
You have been in here for several hours, father.
Vivenna bowed her head respectfully to Yarda.
The servants speak of a colorful envelope carried by the general when he entered. I believe I know what it contained.
Dedalyn met her eyes, then waved for her to seat herself. Yarda remained standing after the masculine fashion. Vivenna eyed the letter sitting on the desk. She was calm, her hair controlled and kept a respectful black. She was twice as devout as Dedalyn, and, unlike her youngest sister, she never drew attention to herself with fits of emotion.
I assume that I should prepare myself for departure then.
Dedalyn opened his mouth but could find no objection. He glanced at Yarda, who just shook his head, resigned.
I have prepared my entire life for this, father. I am ready. Ciri, however, will not take this well. She left on a ride an hour ago. I should depart the city before she gets back. That will avoid any potential scene she might make.
Too late.
Yarda nodded toward the window. Just outside, people scattered in the courtyard as a figure galloped through the gates. She wore a deep brown cloak that bordered on being too colorful, and, of course, she had her hair down. The hair was yellow. Dedalyn felt his rage and frustration growing. Only Ciri could make him lose control, and, as if in ironic counterpoint to the source of his anger, he felt his hair change. To those watching, a few locks of hair on his head would have bled from black to red. It was the identifying mark of the royal family who had fled to the Idris Highlands at the climax of the Many War. Others could hide their emotions. The royals, however, manifest what they felt in the very hair on their heads. Ravenna watched him, pristine as always, and her poise gave him strength as he forced his hair to turn black again. With more willpower than any common man could understand to control the treasonous royal locks. Dedalyn wasn't sure how Ravenna managed it so well.
Poor girl, never even had a childhood.
From birth, Vivenna's life had been pointed toward this single event. His firstborn child, the girl who had always seemed like a part of himself. The girl who had always made him proud. The woman who had already earned the love and respect of her people. In his mind's eye, he saw the queen she could become, stronger even than he. Someone who could guide them through the dark days ahead. But only if she survived that long.
I will prepare myself for the trip.
No.
Yarda and Vivenna both turned.
Father, if we break this treaty, it will mean war. I am prepared to sacrifice for our people. You taught me that.
You will not go.
Dedalyn turned back toward the window. Outside, Ciri was laughing with one of the stablemen. Her hair had turned a flame-colored red.
Lord God of Colors, forgive me. What a terrible choice for a father to make. The treaty is specific. I must send the Halandran my daughter when Vivenna reaches her 21st birthday. But it doesn't actually say which daughter I'm required to send.
If he didn't send Halandran one of his daughters, they would attack immediately. If he sent the wrong one, they might be angered, but he knew they wouldn't attack. They would wait until they had an heir. That would gain Idris at least 9 months.
And if they were to try to use Vivenna against me, I know that I wouldn't be able to stop myself from giving in.
It was shameful to admit that fact, but in the end, it was what made the decision for him. Dedalyn turned back toward the room.
Vivenna, you will not go to wed the tyrant god of our enemies. I'm sending Ciri in your place.
Ciri sat stunned in a rattling carriage, her homeland growing more and more distant with each bump and shake. 2 days had passed, and she still didn't understand. This was supposed to be Vivenna's task. Everybody understood that. Idris had thrown a celebration on the day of Vivenna's birth. The king had started her classes from the day she could walk, training her in the ways of court life and politics. Boffin, the second daughter, had also taken the lessons in case Vivenna died before the day of the wedding. But not Ciri. She'd been redundant, unimportant, no more. She glanced out the window. Her father had sent the kingdom's nicest carriage, along with an honor guard of 20 soldiers, to bear her southward. That, combined with a steward and several serving boys, made for a procession as grand as Ciri had ever seen. It bordered on ostentation, which might have thrilled her had it not been bearing her away from Idris.
This isn't the way it's supposed to be. This isn't the way any of it is supposed to happen.
And yet it had. Nothing made sense. The carriage bumped, but she just sat, numb.
At the very least, they could have at least let me ride horseback, rather than forcing me to sit in this carriage.
But that, unfortunately, wouldn't have been an appropriate way to enter Halandran. Halandran. Ciri felt her hair bleach white with fear. She was being sent to Halandran. A kingdom her people cursed with every second breath. She wouldn't see her father again for a long while, if ever. She wouldn't speak with Vivenna, or listen to the tutors, or be chided by Mab, or ride the royal horses, or go looking for flowers in the wilderness, or work in the kitchens. She'd marry the God King. The terror of Halandran, the monster that had never drawn a living breath. In Halandran, his power was absolute. He could order an execution on a whim.
I'll be safe, though. Won't I? I'll be his wife. Wife? I'm getting married. Oh, Ostrey, God of Colors.
Ciri curled up with her legs against her chest, her hair growing so white that it seemed to shine, and lay down on the seat of the carriage, not sure if the shaking she felt was her own trembling or the carriage continuing its inexorable path southward.
I think that you should reconsider your decision, Father.
Vivenna sat calmly, sitting decorously, as she'd been trained, with hands in her lap.
I've considered and reconsidered, Vivenna. My mind is made up.
Ciri is not suited to this task.
She'll do fine. All she really needs to do is have a baby. I'm certain she's suited to that task.
What then of my training? 22 years of preparation? What was that, if the only point in being sent was to provide a convenient womb?
Vivenna kept her hair black, her face calm.
Ciri must be distraught. I don't think she's emotionally capable of dealing with this.
Her father looked up, his hair fading a bit red, the black bleeding away, like paint running off a canvas. It showed his annoyance.
He's more upset by her departure than he's willing to admit.
This is for the best of our people, Vivenna.
Dedalyn worked, with obvious effort, to turn his hair black again.
If war comes, Idris will need you here.
If war comes, what of Ciri?
Perhaps it won't come.
Austri. He doesn't believe that. He thinks he's sent her to her death.
I know what you're thinking.
Her father drew Vivenna's attention back to his eyes. So solemn.
How could I choose one over the other? How could I send Ciri to die and leave you here to live? I didn't do it based on personal preference, no matter what people may think. I did what will be best for Idris when this war comes.
When this war comes? I was going to stop the war, Father. I was to be the God King's bride. I was going to speak with him, persuade him. I've been trained with the political knowledge, the understanding of customs.
Stop the war? Vivenna, child, there is no stopping this war. Only the promise of a daughter of the royal line kept them away this long, and sending Ciri may buy us time. And perhaps I've sent her to safety, even when war flares. Perhaps they will value her bloodline to the point that they leave her alive. A backup should the heir she bears pass away. Yes, perhaps it is not Ciri we should be fearing for, but...
But ourselves.
Vivenna was not privy to all of her father's war planning, but she knew enough. War would not favor Idris. In a conflict with Halandrin, there was little chance they would win. It would be devastating for their people and their way of life.
Father, I...
Please, Vivenna. I cannot speak of this further. Go now. We will converse later.
Later. After Ciri had traveled even further away. After it would be much more difficult to bring her back without looking foolish. Yet Vivenna rose. She was obedient. It was the way she had been trained. That was one of the things that had always separated her from her sister. Vivenna left her father's study, then walked through the wooden palace hallways, pretending that she didn't see the stairs or hear the whispers. She made her way to a room, which was small and unadorned, and sat down on her bed, hands in her lap. She didn't agree at all with her father's assessment. She could have done something. She was to have been the God King's bride. That would have given her influence in the court. Everyone knew that the God King himself was distant when it came to the politics of his nation. But surely his wife could have played a role in defending the interests of her people. And her father had thrown that away?
He really must believe that there is nothing that can be done to stop the invasion.
That turned sending Ciri into simply another political maneuver to buy time. Just like Idris had been doing for decades. Either way, if the sacrifice of a royal daughter to the Halandrin was that important, then it still should have been Vivenna's place to go. It had always been her duty to prepare for marriage to the God King. Not Ciri's, not Fafin's, Vivenna's. In being saved, she didn't feel grateful. Nor did she feel that she would better serve Idris by staying in Bavalis. If her father died, Yarda would be far better suited to rule during wartime than Vivenna. Besides, Ridger, Vivenna's younger brother, had been groomed as heir for years. She had been preserved for no other reason. It seemed a punishment in some ways. She'd listened, prepared, learned, and practiced. Everyone said that she was perfect. Why then wasn't she good enough to serve as intended? She had no good answer for herself. She could only sit and fret, hands in her lap, and face the awful truth. Her purpose in life had been stolen and given to another. She was redundant now. Useless. Unimportant.
What was he thinking?
Ciri hung half out of the window of her carriage as it bounced along the earthen road. A young soldier marched beside the vehicle, looking uncomfortable in the afternoon light.
I mean, really, sending me to marry the Halandran king? That's silly, isn't it? Surely you've heard about the things that I do. Wandering off when nobody's looking, ignoring my lessons. I throw angry fits for color's sake.
The guard glanced at her out of the corner of his eye, but otherwise gave no reaction. Ciri didn't really care. She wasn't yelling at him so much as just yelling. She hung precariously from the window, feeling the wind play with her hair, long, red, straight, and stoking her anger. Fury kept her from weeping. The green spring hills of the Idris Highlands had slowly faded away as the days had passed. In fact, they were probably in Halandran already. The border between the two kingdoms was vague, which wasn't surprising, considering that they'd been one nation up until the Many War. Ciri eyed the poor guard, whose only way of dealing with a raving princess was ignoring him. She finally slumped back into the carriage. She shouldn't have treated him so, but, well, she'd just been sold off like some hunk of mutton, doomed by a document that had been written years before she'd even been born. If anyone had a right to a tantrum, it was Ciri.
Maybe that's the reason for all of this. Father was tired of my tantrums and just wanted to get rid of me.
That seemed a little far-fetched. There were easier ways to deal with Ciri, ways that didn't include sending her to represent Idris in a foreign court. Why, then? Did he really think she'd do a good job? That gave her pause. Then she considered how ridiculous it was. Her father wouldn't have assumed that she'd do a better job than Vivenna. Nobody did anything better than Vivenna. Ciri felt her hair turn a pensive brown. At least the landscape was interesting. And in order to keep herself from feeling any more frustrated, she let it distract her for the moment. Halandran was in the lowlands, a place of tropical forests and strange, colorful animals. Ciri had heard the descriptions from ramblemen, and even confirmed their accounts in the occasional books she'd been forced to read. She thought she knew what to expect. Yet as the hills gave way to deep grasslands, and then the trees finally began to crowd the road, Ciri began to realize that there was something no tome or tale could adequately describe. Colors. In the highlands, flower patches were rare and unconnected, as if they understood how poorly they fit with Idris' philosophy. Here, they appeared to be everywhere. Tiny flowers grew in great blanketing swaths on the ground. Large, drooping pink blossoms hung from trees like bundles of grapes. Flowers growing practically on top of one another in a large cluster. Even the weeds had flowers. Ciri would have picked some of them if not for the way that the soldiers regarded them with hostility.
If I feel this anxious, those guards must feel more so.
Ciri wasn't the only one who had been sent away from family and friends. When would these men be allowed to return? Suddenly, she felt even more guilty for subjecting the young soldier to her outburst.
I'll send them back when I arrive.
Then, she immediately felt her hair grow white. Sending the men back would leave her alone in a city filled with lifeless awakeners and pagans. Yet, what good would 20 soldiers do her? Better that someone, at least, be allowed to return home.
One would think that you would be happy. After all, you no longer have to marry a tyrant.
Vivenna plopped a bruised, colored berry into her basket, then moved on to a different bush. Fafn worked on one nearby. She wore the white robes of a monk, her hair completely shorn. Fafn was the middle sister in almost every way. Midway between Ciri and Vivenna in height, less proper than Vivenna, yet hardly as careless as Ciri. Fafn was a bit curvier than either of them, which had caught the eyes of several young men in the village. However, the fact that they would have to become monks themselves if they wanted to marry her kept them in check. If Fafn had noticed how popular she was, she'd never shown it. She'd made the decision to become a monk before her 10th birthday, and her father had wholeheartedly approved. Every noble or rich family was traditionally obligated to provide one person to the monasteries. It was against the five visions to be selfish, even with one's own blood. The two sisters gathered berries which Fafn would later distribute to those in need. The monk's fingers were dyed slightly purple by the work. Vivenna wore gloves. That much color on her hands would be unseemly.
Yes, I do think you're taking this all wrong. Why, you act as if you want to go down and be married to that lifeless monster.
He's not lifeless. Susa Brunn has returned, and there is a large difference.
Yes, but he's a false god. Besides, everyone knows what a terrible creature he is.
But it was my place to go and marry him. That is who I am, Fafn. Without it, I am nothing.
Nonsense. You'll inherit now, instead of Ridger.
Thereby unsettling the order of things even further. What right do I have to take his place from him?
Vivenna allowed this aspect of the conversation to lapse, however. She'd been arguing the point for several minutes now, and it wouldn't be proper to continue. Proper. Rarely before had Vivenna felt so frustrated at having to be proper. Her emotions were growing rather inconvenient.
What of Ciri? You're happy that this happened to her?
Fafn looked up, then frowned a little to herself. She had a tendency to avoid thinking things through unless she was confronted with them directly. Vivenna felt a little ashamed for making such a blunt comment, but with Fafn, there often wasn't any other way.
You do have a point. I don't see why anyone had to be sent.
The treaty. It protects our people.
Ostri protects our people.
Will he protect Ciri?
Poor, innocent, capricious Ciri. She'd never learned to control herself. She'd be eaten alive in the Halandrin Court of Gods. Ciri wouldn't understand the politics, the backstabbing, the false faces and lies. She would also be forced to bear the next God King of Halandrin. Performing that duty was not something Vivenna had looked forward to. It would have been a sacrifice, yet it would have been her sacrifice, given willingly for the safety of her people. Such thoughts continued to pester Vivenna as she and Fafn finished with the berry picking, then moved down the hillside back toward the village. Fafn, like all monks, dedicated all of her work to the good of the people. She watched flocks, harvested food, and cleaned houses for those who could not do it themselves. Without a duty of her own, Vivenna had little purpose. And yet, as she considered it, there was someone who still needed her. Someone who had left a week before, teary-eyed and frightened, looking to her big sister with desperation. Vivenna wasn't needed in Idris, whatever her father said. She was useless here. But she did know the people, cultures, and society of Halandrin. And, as she followed Fafn onto the village road, an idea began to form in Vivenna's head. One that was not, by any stretch of the imagination, proper.